Hello, and welcome to the Atonicast. I'm Kirsten Korosek, and as always, I am joined with my two lovely co-hosts, Ed Niedermeyer and Alex Roy. Hi, guys.
Hey, Kirsten.
Hey, Kirsten. I love your new NPR voice now that you're the Kara Swisher of transportation.
I hope that Kara doesn't hear that, because I don't think there's a lot of comparison there, but thank you.
Well, you're the best, so thank you for starting off.
You're just saying that because I still have your vehicle in my possession.
That's true.
So this is the time of year where everyone, I'm sure Ed is probably working on something. I certainly am, on the end of the year type story as a reflecting back. But I thought that, and we all thought actually, that it'd be more interesting to sort of look at 2 years, what has happened in 2 years in the future of transportation, specifically in the sort of autonomous vehicle space, because it has sort of gone from this, I mean, it was at the height of the hype cycle, I think, possibly in December 2016. Everything seemed possible and everything seemed like it was going to happen tomorrow. That has come kind of crashing down, but there's also been quite a bit of progress as well. And Ed, you actually kind of recently wrote about that.
Yeah. Let's see, a little bit over a month ago. Getting on 2 months ago, I wrote about a ride I took in Waymo's Pacifica minivan. And I was comparing a ride I took in this Waymo van back in October with a ride I took in what was at the time the Google self-driving programs, it was a Lexus, I think, test vehicle, on the same route in 2016. So I kind of had these two rides 2 years apart. And as you say, you know, the hype around autonomous vehicles has come crashing down since 2016. And we've discussed this a bunch on the show. But what's fascinating to me, and what just provided a really interesting contrast, is that the progress that these companies are making on autonomous vehicles hasn't stopped. The ride I got in the Waymo vehicle this October was really significantly better in a lot of different ways than the ride I got in the Google self-driving.
So are you saying, Ed, that you're confident that these companies are going to emerge from the trough of disillusionment with real solutions?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the biggest problem has been that we've sort of framed self-driving cars through the lens of sort of cars, period, right? And I think that led us to this idea of level five of an autonomous vehicle that can go anywhere, anytime, because that concept comes from the way we think about our cars right now. We buy them, generally speaking, not optimized for, you know, sort of 90% of our use cases. We buy them for the 5 or 10% or even 1% of use cases that are the most extreme that we need. And you know, maybe just once a year, like when we go up to the mountains or you know, go out to the desert or whatever else. and so I think we've kind of, because we thought about autonomous vehicles the way we think about our cars, we sort of set them up for this failure or this perceived failure. And I think what is happening, and I think some of our, you know, the smart guests that we've had on the show, I know Horace Didier definitely said this, the trough of disillusionment is not a bad thing. Actually, I'm sorry, I'm thinking of Jim Adler. Said this, the trough of disillusionment is not a bad thing. It's what gets us to reality. And I think that one of the big things that we've seen in the last 2 years is just much more focus on, you know, not just delivering or developing a technology that can sort of do it all, because I think that was too much, but really focusing on where this technology can have an impact in the short term. And I think, you know, our last guest, Oliver Cameron from Voyage, is just a really fantastic example of how important that is, of finding the place where you can make a really positive impact and you can do it safely.
Yeah, a company that didn't exist 2 years ago, by the way.
Yeah. So to answer your question, Alex, like, I think, yeah, the there's two things that make me optimistic, more optimistic now than I was in 2016, I think, about autonomous vehicles. And one is that the technological progress has continued and is really quite impressive if you just look at that Also, I think these companies are getting more realistic about what this technology can actually do. And I think you combine those two factors, and you can start to see opportunities.
So I want to, before you jump in, Alex, set the stage a little bit, because I think that there's just to look back. So if we're going to take a snapshot from 2 years ago today, we would know this, and we wouldn't know anything of the future. But 2 years ago, around this time, Waymo became something. Waymo didn't exist before. It was Google's self-driving project. It spun out. Now it's a business under Alphabet, so it became a business. Cruise had, earlier that year in March, been acquired by GM. Uber had bought Otto, an autonomous trucking company, founded by Anthony Lewandowski, Leo Aron, a couple of others, for I think around $680 million, although it ended up being less that August. And then Qualcomm had spent about $39 billion taking over NXP Semiconductors, which is relevant in this greater battle, I guess.
And also Tesla started selling full self-driving capability. that also happened in late 2016. I think it was really emblematic of where things were at that time.
Right. So that is the NVIDIA was, you know, really doubling down investment in not just AI, but specifically self-driving cars as an application of that. And as a result, its stock price was just going through the roof. And I think Intel said at that time it would invest something like $250 million in autonomous driving. And that's not including all the other OEM plans. That was what was 2 years ago at this time would exist in the world. Of course, a lot has happened since then.
I can't stop thinking about Anton Wallman's op-ed, which just came out in the street, where he says that he thinks that self-driving will be the biggest write-down in the history of the automotive sector, and one of the biggest in the tech sector too.
And how now, many, do you believe that?
I do believe that's true for some of the companies. You know, how many companies can there be making a full-stack solution that actually becomes a viable business that they can actually sell? In the old days of the PCs, you had Intel, you had Motorola, and Intel ran the Intel Inside campaign, and Motorola didn't. And Intel became synonymous with quality, and eventually Apple adopted Intel chips. So how many companies can be selling a full stack? How many companies want to buy it? How many car companies are there? Because it's very easy, I mean, back in the day, to start a PC company. You just assembled PCs. But it's not easy to start a car company, as we know from our friend in Fremont. So you've got, 14, 15, 16 big car companies in the world. But those guys are going to consolidate. So can there be three or four companies building full stack solutions? And that whole time, Oliver Cameron is signing exclusive deals in this constellation, this archipelago of retirement communities across the American South, which are optimized for level four. So if I were, you know, a betting man, whichever full stack company or car company that has a full stack investment goes out and buys Voyage now and hires Oliver Cameron as head of biz dev, that's the company I think is not going to may have to make a write down. But the guys who are just chugging along hoping for the best, or toast.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you on one point, which is that sometimes when a big company comes in and buys a company that is on the right track, it can jumble up and really halt the progress that was being made. So, you know, there's all sorts of examples about that, where a company buys a really promising startup and then it doesn't go anywhere and the company ends up having to do a write down. So, you know, while I'm sure it would be great if Voyage was acquired for Oliver Cameron and the folks who work there, they might end up not making more progress as a result. So okay. The caveat to me would be it would really depend on the company and whether that was a right match as to whether they that acquisition was worth it or not, and whether they end up not writing it down. Really, what's interesting is I think a lot of write downs are going to happen in the greater mobility space
of
as
course.
Well, beyond just autonomous vehicles. Like companies buying up digital platform companies and car sharing and ride hailing and ride sharing and all these other iterations that are happening, because really OEMs and a lot of other companies see an opportunity, but they isn't quite figured out, or not everyone has figured out exactly how that's going to play out. That's still the case. That was the case 2 years ago. It's the case now.
Well, look at Mercedes and BMW merging their mobility ventures, right? They went out, both of them bought a bunch of companies, started a bunch of companies, started a bunch of businesses, and now they're pushing them all together. And so I think Alex is right that in that, you know, you can believe in this technology, you can believe that mobility is going to change fundamentally, but also believe that there has been overinvestment in this space and that maybe the market can't actually support quite as many, you know, full stack companies in particular as, you know, people thought. Because frankly, one thing we haven't heard from really any of these companies is sort of what will fundamentally differentiate their autonomous stack from a consumer perspective or an efficiency and operations perspective from any other one. Is there a competitive advantage to be gained by using one company system rather than the others? I don't know.
Well, you know what Brad Templeton said in his, I think a few months ago, he said that since nobody knows how the technology is going to work for sure, where it's going to work, or what the business model around it is that makes sense, that all the big players are going to put their pieces on the board, but no one is going to try to take over the same spot. So you're going to have, you know, different companies in different cities, and you're not going to see any two companies go head to head in any city for a long time. And once the pieces are all on the board and someone has shown that a city actually makes sense, that it is a viable market, the business model attached, someone else will move in for real.
You don't think that something is going to I think that there is going to be some interesting competition that's going to happen in the Phoenix area and in the San Francisco area and maybe even Pittsburgh. And I say it because those are already hubs of activity for testing and development, but we're seeing actual deployments happening now. Granted, incredibly limited, but Nuro, for example, is got an autonomous delivery business that has officially launched in Scottsdale, and Waymo is doing very limited rides in the Phoenix suburbs.
Waymo. Sorry, guys. I have friends at Waymo, but please. Like that's not fully baked. And Nuro, in fact, I'm in.
How is it not fully baked? There's
people in the cars. What's his name? Tim Berners-Lee. Tim Berners-Lee says they can't find a customer. Timothy Lee, not the inventor of the internet, the other guy.
Yeah.
That's just not serious. And
okay, well, how is it not serious? And I'm going to say this because if let's just say Waymo completely went full out and said, yep, we're going for it. They do a more fly by the seat of our pants, Anthony Lewandowski style deployment. You'd be sitting here right now completely criticizing them for not being
enough. No, yes, not true. If they could do this the way that everyone actually, even I would love to have a self-driving taxi service. Driving sucks a lot of places. Then there would be flooding the media with users running Facebook Live, cruising around and having a grand old time.
Of course, so just because they're more conservative and because they're taking a more cautious and slow approach doesn't mean it's half-baked. It might be misguided in some ways in terms of marketing or really showing that they're serious. But to me, it doesn't necessarily mean it's
half-baked. Let me pick it back. Okay. The Waymo cake is still in the oven. The door's open and they're cutting little pieces off for people who want to eat dessert. That's what's happening.
That's
it's a delicious cake. It's a cake everybody wants, but they won't take it out of the oven yet. But you don't. I think Brett Templeton is right. I think no one wants to go head to head when the tech isn't ready and the business models aren't fully fleshed out. And I think Oliver Cameron and May Mobility are going to start signing up cities to the longest possible contracts they can, and those are going to be two big exits in the future. That both those companies matter a lot more than almost any of the announcements we see from anyone else.
Well, and I think one of the questions in all this is, you know, when sort of a program that's as ambitious as Waymo does decide that the cake is fully baked, And I agree with you that, like, I mean, I think everybody in this space has had communication issues of some kind or another, just about. But, you know, the question to me is if, you know, when they decide that the cake is fully baked, will that cake have more applicability in more cases? In other words, will they have the sort of flexibility and capability to then sort of, you know, go much faster into new markets than a company that has really focused on a very limited domain and maybe got into operations quicker, but maybe with a more fundamentally limited system? So there's a little bit of a short-term versus long-term optimization question here.
I'm sure there's a database of all the towns and cities, you know, in certainly the developed world that match certain criteria, and then you just line them up, and that's where you send your biz dev guys.
Well, I'm sure that's probably happening. But, you know, I think it would be interesting right now is to reflect for a moment on the tale of two companies. And you can argue that, or you can try and argue that Waymo is a half-baked cake or things like that. But let's compare them for a moment about, for the last 2 years, what Waymo's done and what Uber's done. And in the span of 2 years, these companies have sued each other, or Waymo's filed a lawsuit against Uber and settled. Uber came into California, had to leave California, was welcomed with open arms into Arizona, had to halt that program after the first, you know, fatality from a self-driving vehicle when in March of this past year, Elaine Hertzberg was a pedestrian, was hit and subsequently died from her injuries. And now has gone back to some manual driving. And now again, a very small fleet, like less than a handful. We're talking four or five vehicles, or maybe relaunching a self-driving project in or testing on public roads in Pittsburgh in an incredibly limited area in the Strip District. Now starting also to do some manual driving in San Francisco and Toronto. Meanwhile, Waymo has hundreds of vehicles with its Pacifica hybrid in the Phoenix area, is also testing, continues to test in Mountain View, has actually been testing a business model with the early rider program. Granted, there's some problems with that. And, you know, it's not as large as we might like, but has been doing that. Also signed a contract with Jaguar I-Pace with the I-Pace. We'll see where that goes. I mean, it could not be a more stark difference between those two companies. And that's been the same span of year, and they've crossed paths very often.
Yeah.
It's funny because Anton Wallman says Waymo is the only company that could write off their entire unit and it wouldn't really matter.
I mean, this is true.
Well, yeah.
Google has a lot of cash and a very, yeah, very solid business.
Yep. And that's a great comfort. That's a good, comfortable place to be in too, right? Because it's not as maybe risky as it is for a company like Uber that doesn't have that.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the pieces of this that is important too is that Uber has really pivoted its entire strategy. Like under Travis Kalanick 2 years ago, the strategy was, you know, we have this ride hailing product. And if we can develop technology that lets us get the drivers out of that, that takes away one of our major business obstacles and, you know, will potentially get us to profitability. You know, they didn't get the chance to test that theory because of their technological and operational issues. But I think in retrospect, that looks like a little bit of a limited perspective. And what they've done is they pivoted to the idea of a multimodal platform. And then all of a sudden, you know, developing the technology isn't as important for them.
Right.
They want to essentially be, you know, have everybody, every service provider and every fleet to the extent possible on, you know, available on their platform so that they are the platform. They're the Amazon of mobility. And I think that, you know, makes more sense given that, you know, their business was never really about being more technologically advanced than everyone else. Like their software has always seemed relatively simple to me. And I don't want to, no disrespect to their developers. It's obviously, you know, brilliant, complex stuff, but I think their real competitive advantage has always come from their scale. They scaled really, really fast and platforms are built on scale. And so if they can consolidate that position, they will have a place in the future of mobility, without necessarily having to, you know, own their own fleets, which I think was, you know, didn't fit well with their asset light model in the first place.
I was just thinking, you know, there's one really great benefit of the hype cycle that happened, which is that it encouraged a ton of people who had been working, for example, at the Google self-driving project, or had been in academia, or had been in the, I heard this story commonly, had been part of some of the earlier DARPA challenges, went and worked for other companies doing other things, and then felt the need to get back to what they wanted to do originally and work on autonomous vehicle technology. And because of some progress on the processing front and some other areas, they were encouraged to do that. And so as a result, like 2 years ago, Aurora was an idea, not yet. I think it formally became a company, technically, I think January in 2017. Argo AI, for example, is another example of that. All these other companies, now you have all these people, instead of being under one company or one project or one university or a handful of them, are spread out attracting new talent, granted, hard to get talent, and they're all working on this. So I think that the progress, while slow, will start ramping up a little bit, especially now that there's not as much of that hype attention on acquisitions and fundraising and stuff like that that's going on, that had been going on the last like a year and a half, 2 years.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the interesting things, I think I mentioned this on our earlier show, you know, I moderated a panel for Toyota AI Ventures. What was really interesting there was sort of noticing how many companies, newer companies that have just been founded in the last year or so, really seem to be super focused. So rather than being this sort of gold rush to, you know, get out ahead of this sort of horse race to be, you know, the most advanced full stack developer or whatever else, you know, small companies are being started to focus on very specific tasks within the stack. And most of them say that their business model is that they don't want to be acquired by one of these developers. They want to work with multiple developers. And I think that's a reflection of the fact that there has been a little bit of overinvestment, and it's been driven a little bit by this sort of FOMO and like sense that you need to have your own full stack developer, otherwise you're not a serious player. And it just seems like it's a reflection of sort of getting back to reality and realizing, look, there's a lot of really hard problems, and that maybe building a small, tight team of people who are just the best people to address one part in this huge stack of problems may be more effective. And that if they can, you know, solve that problem for a bunch of different customers, then you don't have that overinvestment. You have one small, tight team providing a lot of value to a lot of players. Now, that raises this question of like, okay, when this process is all done, you know, do any of these full stack developers actually have a
business,
a mode? Well, like, or just a comparative advantage? You know, I think that is a question.
Well, if the sector could get off their asses and actually do something that would create, like, I mean, I guess define safety in some way, or create the underwriter's laboratory of self-driving, or something that would make it possible to rank or rate the companies such that, you know, there's any way of knowing like who's actually in the lead. I mean, nobody knows anything. There might be some value here. You know, this whole time people were cracking jokes about the Human Driving Association. I was complaining that ADAS was floundering and going nowhere, and while everyone talks about level 4 and 5. And suddenly, you know, in the last month, with all these articles about this trough of disillusionment, you see, you know, ADAS coming back. You know, Junko Yoshida wrote this article a few days ago about how ADAS is going to be bigger in the next, you know, 5-10 years. And then Kirsten, your friend Lewandowski, you had a few conversations with him, didn't you? You ever spoken to him?
No, I've never. I actually have just followed his paper trail. I did hear through the grapevine that he was impressed that I found his new business, but I don't think he was, you know, terribly happy about it.
Well, so Lewandowski comes out the other day and he announces that Pronto AI, and he's got the headline said self-driving truck, but all this is basically a level 2 system that looks like it's built on top of some open source, you know, technologies, including potentially George Hotz's, you know, OpenPilot. So if that's the best that Lewandowski can do, then there is a lot of opportunities been squandered in level 2 and like augmented driving technologies, which, you know, I've been talking about for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious to see what he does, because the line that you said, the best he can do, I mean, I think part of it is that he was involved in like a lawsuit and that whole thing, which can be a bit of a, you know, it can be a bit of a headwind.
Are you saying that he'd have trouble raising venture capital money?
Oh, I'm sure there are some people who, I mean, he's a really smart guy. So I'm sure there are people who will follow him wherever he goes. And I'm sure there will be an investor out there for him. But I do think that you, when you're under that sort of scrutiny, fairly so, that it's hard to like get down to business and make progress on stuff. And also, he really couldn't go the LiDAR approach anymore.
Right.
He's suddenly calling it the crutch technology, right? Which is very similar to the same verbiage that Elon Musk uses. And now he's taking more of a camera-based approach. So let's see where he's at. I mean, look at what's happened in the last 2 years with that guy. Let's see what happens in 2019. Very curious to see where he goes with that.
Okay, here's my prediction for the sector for the next 12 months based on the last 2 years. So $100 and some odd billion poured into primarily to level four. And the only things on the streets that matter, combining a business model and technology, is Voyage and May Mobility. I mean, you want to add Waymo, be my guest. But all the underlying technology, so the sensor hardware, part some of the software, and a lot of the maps, all of those things, if you glue them together, you try to, you know, chop off a lower branch, you're chopping off ADAS. How can ADAS benefit from integrating maps and the better sensor hardware and the lessons learned from, you know, this level four, you know, shit show? Sorry, no, explicit warning just went up. So that's where we're going to see real application of those teams that you're talking about, Ed, you know, because investors are going to want to see, and, you know, marketers want to see technologies, not that work in 10 years over there, but stuff that works in 24 months anywhere. And that's going to be super ADAS. It's augmented driving, and the Human Driving Association and Alex Roy support that.
I'm actually surprised we haven't seen more of sort of that augmented driving concept that you coined, and you know, TRI and Gil Pratt are sort of the main really the only folks out there actually who are really talking about that. I think there's just a real opportunity, because I think that the danger, right, is that we have all this excitement about level four or full autonomy. And that, you know, I think there is going to be a lot more investment in ADAS, or you're already seeing it. And that, you know, there's the risk that we start to see ADAS as that the consumers, you know, don't understand these differences. And I think that, you know, what I would love to see is more of a focus on, you know, engineering ADAS in a way that, you know, augments the human driver rather than sort of, you know, putting them in a position of having to babysit some sort of like not really autonomous, but kind of autonomous seeming automation.
Did you ask Adler, or when you saw him, what was going on with that, or Pratt, if you saw him?
No, I didn't. We were, our discussion was sort of about investment more broadly in the space. But I mean, I think the, you know, the challenge is that, right, like automating, you know, steering inputs or automating adaptive cruise control is relatively easy at this point. Mm-hmm. And that to really actually deliver on the Guardian concept, you almost have to have full autonomy working, because, you know, that's essentially what's happening. It's a fully autonomous safety net around a human driver. And so it may be a while before we see some of this stuff come to market. And I think that's a little bit of the, you know, the issue with augmented driving.
Guys, do you want to talk about Boring Company, or do you want to move to our special guest?
Well, do we want to talk about Boring Company?
Yeah, how bumpy was it, Kirsten? Because like everyone mentioned that, but like it's hard to quantify.
It was like it kind of felt like a wooden roller coaster ride in terms of the just sort of the being bounced around. It wasn't smooth at all. Or maybe driving kind of fast on a dirt fire road. Little, you know, it wasn't like I was going to get ill. It wasn't like that at all. But it was like no one would ever ride in this. Now, when we were in the press conference, Elon said, we were asked, you know, we all asked about that. And he basically said, yeah, we ran out of time. And we've been working on the paving, and the paving will be smoother.
Sounded like he was blaming a supplier, which is kind of part of the.
No, I mean, I think that they were doing that. I don't know if they're using an outside supplier. I think that they were doing it themselves.
Oh, okay.
So the whole event seemed a little contrived, and I spoke with some longtime Tesla fans, people who have like owned, you know, have the first Roadster, have multiple S's and X's. I mean, the biggest fans, right? And they were like, yeah, we're here because why not? But whatever. Like, it wasn't like they were brooding against Elon because they're big fans of Tesla.
Right.
They were kind of like, why? Why are we here?
Yeah.
But they're like, yeah, we'll come here anyway and see what next crazy thing he's doing. The demonstration product and all that was like a little silly.
You mean a little like guidance wheels that go on your Tesla?
Yeah, that and also the one thing that like no one really pointed out was that, you know, he said specifically this is for electric autonomous vehicles, implying that like and very quickly said, but not just for Teslas. The thing is that Teslas aren't autonomous right now. And so I'm not sure what vehicle could go in there.
Guys, I mean, I'm not defending Elon here, but based on my read of his personality, there's going to be I can't believe I'm inventing this excuse for him, but a tunnel is a pretty geofenced, you know, situation. It wouldn't be that difficult to create a tunnel mode, which, you know, just follow, just went.
Sure, I mean, sure. But there's all sorts of questions. Like if someone hit the brake and disengaged it, then all these other cars flowing at 150 sure. miles an hour, what would happen? I mean, there are like, I got one question in during the press conference. I would have liked to have sat down with him and Steve Davis and asked about 100 more questions about every little aspect of it. But, you know, there wasn't the time to do that.
My take on this is that, you know, Elon Musk goes into these very complex businesses and gets a ton of benefit of the doubt that he's going to be able to come up with, you know, that he's just going to do it better than these businesses that have been around for a long time, that have had a lot of competition, a lot of big companies, a lot of smart people working at them. And, you know, I think the technology media and all of us, right? I mean, like it's hard for us to go into this whole new area that we don't really know and educate ourselves to an extent where we can really contextualize like how valuable his contributions to these things are. I think just from looking at the auto industry side of it, I think there are probably some areas, you know, if this is like Tesla, there will be some areas where this effort will have some contributions, some positive contributions, but it may not, you know, be sort of something that will actually, you know, genuinely take over the entire business. And I think with Tesla, if you look at how it was covered, right, there was a big disconnect between sort of the people who saw the positive contributions and the people who were like, yeah, but like there's all this other stuff that has to be done as well for a company to be sustainable.
Hey, Ed, you're sounding really reasonable today, and maybe it's because you have a new title as, you know, senior editor at The Drive. Very impressive. So let's switch places for a second here. This tunnel is stupid. The demonstration was stupid. If there was anything serious happening here, they should have just waited until they had something serious to show. I'm not disappointed because my expectations were so low, but man, this really takes the wind out of the sails of somebody who's tried to be a Tesla fan despite everything other than the cars, which I like.
The thing that kills me about Elon Musk is that, like, why can we not just say he has some good ideas and some bad ideas?
Of course.
Like, sorry, point-to-point rockets is a completely stupid idea.
No, it's so cool. You're wrong.
Yeah, dumping tons of carbon into the atmosphere so that people can get to the other side of the world.
Nobody cares,
and yet this is the key underlying, like, issue with this car company. Like, how can you care about one thing and not about it? Like, carbon is the most important thing when you're talking about cars, but it's the least important thing when we're talking about air travel. Like, what the fuck?
Kirsten, can you believe this guy? He's a true believer.
Okay, so let's wrap up the boring company thing because it's getting really fucking boring.
Yeah.
The demonstration project was a show. It was a bit of a sad show, and it was a demonstration project. And, you know, I thought that actually there was a great story today in The Verge about how Elon Musk is the the first influencer CEO. And
what?
Yeah, no, but it was great. It was very well written, and I wanted to hate it, and I actually really loved it. And in that article sort of look back, it basically said, talking about Elon Musk is sort of like betting on a horse race. Like, it's like the odds are against him, but you never know. Or this looks like it's going to happen, but the horse didn't have a very good day today. So like, you just don't really know with this guy, like what exactly. There's so many things that shouldn't happen that do. And so many things that would seem like if he did the right approach would be like a success story, and yet he doesn't do it. So it's like, who the fuck knows? That's like most likely not going to happen. I think I'd put it under that category.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So should we move to our special guest, because a few days ago when Lewandowski showed his cross-country L2, maybe self-driving, but not, you know, whatever truck demonstration, I received a direct message suggesting that there probably was a George Hotz comma panda device on the windshield, which is why we have here a very special surprise holiday guest, George Hotz.
Hi.
All right, George, let's dive right in. Did you hear about Anthony Lewandowski's Pronto AI news yesterday?
So I follow comma AI on Twitter, and I saw Pronto AI was using a gray panda for their drive. And I'm like, who's Pronto AI? I have no idea. And then this morning when you texted me, I found out it was Anthony Lewandowski.
Why don't you explain what a panda is?
So you can see the gray panda antenna visible on the windshield for their drive. A panda is a universal interface that links computers to cars.
So let's be clear here. Lewandowski, everyone's least favorite friend in the sector, has launched a startup called Pronto, and his announcement was made. He claims that he had a car drive cross country, a Toyota Prius, and that it was the first zero disengagement drive cross country, hands off. And he claimed different. It could be level 2, could be level 4, but he had a device on the screen that, in fact, is a comma device. Am I understanding this correctly?
The device on the windshield was a comma device. Yeah, the Panda is a product manufactured and sold by comma AI. But yeah, and as to his cross-country without disengagement claim, it's highly dubious, given that Tesla can't do it.
Okay, so explain what the Panda device enables and what comma's solution enables.
So the Panda is just an interface between computers and cars. Comma also sells an Eon, which is a computer, and gives away software for free called OpenPilot, which you can install on an Eon. The Eon then talks to the Panda and makes decisions about how to turn the wheel and hit the gas and hit the brakes.
So what does it appear that Lewandowski is actually doing? He's got a Toyota. He's got a Panda in there. He's got a bunch of cameras and no LiDAR. So what is he actually built? Or I mean, what's happening here?
It's unclear. It looks like a lot of what he's done is doable with the open source comma AI stuff. This stuff was not, as far as I know, his stuff was not independently verified, or, you know, much better than verification is open source it.
Why do you think he used a panda? What are the alternatives, and why use a panda rather than something else?
Well, I'm not sure. I think you probably used way more than a panda. Look, comma AI gives all of this stuff away. We encourage people. If he used comma AI stuff, I mean, you know, acknowledging it would have been nice, but you don't have to. We encourage people to do exactly this.
All right. So what is his business model theoretically going to be if he's building a solution on top of what you've done and versus what your business model is? Like, what's so special about him?
Oh, I don't know. We'll see.
So what's on the horizon for comma if anyone can show up, download, you know, the, you know, foundational stuff you've built and put out a press release?
Well, the bar is a lot higher now, and the press shouldn't continue to repeat these claims, right? If some new company launches and their stuff is not any more capable than literally comma AI's free open source offering, what are you doing?
Now, I remember asking you, you know, Musk said it, you know, one of the Tesla would go cross country, zero disengagements in 2016. And that didn't happen. And in 2017, I put out an open letter saying, if you're going to do that, I need to be in the car because otherwise it can't be proven. And there's no reply. And that's not going to happen this year either. Now you have Lewandowski out there. So how could – I've thought of a number of ways that this such a drive could be faked. And the number one way is to have disengagements and just conceal them or lie about them. All he's shown is this video, which, you know, because it's a time lapse, you could just remove frames, which would reveal the disengagement. George, how could you fake such a drive or fake the zero disengagement component?
You can just lie. I mean, it's not anything. It's not an accomplishment. This just shows how absurd the whole metrics for the space is. I've said from the beginning, Kamai is going to win self-driving cars. We're not going to win self-driving cars because we're going to pull a rabbit out of a hat. We're going to win self-driving cars because we're not trying to pull rabbits out of hats.
So, you know, I mean, you said earlier that it's not an accomplishment. What would be an accomplishment?
To ship a product that is capable of doing that? To ship that.
And if he shipped it using, like, building off of your components, like, how would that work for you? I mean, would he have to come to an arrangement with you? I mean, I assume the open source license is for non-commercial uses, or am I wrong?
No, of course not. No, he could just totally do that and sell a product. The MIT license is fine for commercial use. It's gotcha. Anybody's to use.
Could it have been as simple as he had many disengagements and edited the video? I mean, is there any way that his car could have gotten across with zero disengagements?
Is it possible? Sure, anything's possible. Does the evidence lend myself to believe this claim? I mean, how do you measure a disengagement? What is a disengagement? The system stayed engaged, but the driver touched the wheel a little? Who knows? Without a rigorous definition, this doesn't mean anything.
Look, if you wanted to send a car equipped with a comma solution across country, I mean, I asked you this a year ago, and you looked at me, and I could see your wheels turning. Is there no commercial value in sending a car across doing this? Or if you wanted to do this, could you?
We're doing it right now. It's called the self-driving awareness tour.
Let's maybe be more clear. Could you get into a vehicle with me and a Panda and OpenPilot and go across and replicate Lewandowski's claim?
So a lot of the work that would go into making that work would be irrelevant for the release of the product. Could I do it? Yeah, but it costs money and it doesn't really gain anything. The better thing to do is, how can we ship a better version of OpenPilot tomorrow?
And why doesn't driving across the country help the product?
Well, why would it, right? It doesn't matter if you can get one car across the country. It matters whether you can ship something that is capable of reliably driving across the country. That's the real amazing claim that anybody can verify.
Okay, but for the sake of argument, like, just imagine that, you know, you're describing this to someone who really doesn't understand much about how these products work. Like, why doesn't, you know, driving across the country, which is like a lot of miles, potentially see a lot of different situations, you know, just in really simple terms, like, why doesn't that contribute to the product in a meaningful way?
Let's say I built a hoverboard and only I have a hoverboard. Well, that would suck. That's useless, especially if I never showed anybody my hoverboard and I just showed some, like, fake Photoshopped pictures of it. What would be really cool is if you could ship a hoverboard to the masses that anybody could buy, and then there's hoverboards on the street. And I mean real hoverboards that actually fly.
Yeah. And what is the kind of work that does enable that? Like, what is your focus, for example, rather than going across country or doing a demonstration like this?
Well, so we have, I'm not sure what the number is right now, but probably about 1,000 people using OpenPilot every day. And every day we drive down the number of disengagements. Every version of OpenPilot is slightly better, hopefully, than the previous version. And it makes slightly less mistakes and it requires correction slightly less.
And what is the performance of OpenPilot look like, and how much has it improved in dark conditions, in rain?
Oh, it's improved massively since the first releases. The first releases, you couldn't go 5 miles without a disengagement. Now you can go hundreds.
It's the trough of disillusionment has been now emerging regarding level 4 solutions. All Lewandowski is claiming is that what you've been doing all along is what's going to fill the gap between now and some level 4 date. Who the hell knows? So
what is the business around building on top of Comma? Like, I don't understand it. Like, I just don't understand what he's even pretending to do.
So with respect to level four, I watched Comma's Periscopes, and Ricardo delivered an incredible smackdown against level four.
That's Biasini, you're the new CEO.
New CEO of Comma, yeah, yes. He said maybe, you know, public transportation already fills the need that level four will serve.
Okay.
So what's the business model to build on top of Comma? Well, you could provide service to Comma fleets. You can build custom hardware for Comma. You can build cars that ship with Comma AI's software. Mm-hmm. Think we're like Android. Think of all the business models on top of Android.
All right, well then let's talk about safety. You know, people, cynics are always saying, oh, HOTS and these guys, you know, they don't care about safety. And you have some very clever answers. But it's become obvious that a lot of the big level, well-funded level four companies have failed to define what safety is. And they're still scrambling to answer basic questions. You know, what is the definition of safe enough to deploy anything commercially?
So there's a big distinction between safety and signaling safety. I've always said repeatedly that I don't care at all about signaling safety. Signaling safety doesn't save lives. That's like saying, we're so safe and we care a lot about safety. Okay, care. Don't tell everybody you care. What does it mean to be safe enough? So for us, the bar is human driving. If our system needs to make driving safer or just as safe as it would be without a human, it would be with a human in full manual control.
The average human?
Yes.
And do you know a metric off the top of your head for what that average human safety is?
So humans crash cars about every 100,000 miles. There's a death about every 100 million miles. So you want to be safer on both of those metrics.
So do you anticipate that, you know, someone using a Comma solution will sign off on a terms of service and assume liability while relying on your system to be safer than them?
Well, so Comma AI takes no liability. I'm not the CEO anymore. I just do research. I don't really know that much about these things. But there's a few things that we do. You know, after the Uber death, we added driver monitoring. And now driver monitoring is mandatory. So when you have our system engaged, it's using the front camera to watch you and make sure you're paying attention to the road. Just that alone kind of makes it safer than normal driving where people are distracted and on their phones.
Is it problematic to like put so much emphasis on disengagements? Like, right, his big claim is he made it across the country without disengagements. Is that really are there problems with that metric?
There's problems almost in every metric when you take optimizing it to an insane degree. If you take optimizing lack of disengagements to an insane degree, yeah, you want to leave the system engaged when it's doing something sketchy. We definitely don't want to encourage that. So no, I don't really think it's something to brag about, but it's something that kind of reflects the quality of the system.
So is it, I mean, obvious, people have been saying Waymo's, you know, light years ahead of everybody for years based on miles driven and these California disengagement reports. Is there any relationship between miles driven and system capability?
Like I said, I'm an old man now. I don't care about your one-off, whatever you've managed to rice the numbers to be. I care about what you've actually shipped. Is this good? Does this feel good? Does it make mistakes often or not much? So is there some relationship? Yes. Is, you know, orders of magnitude says something, but exact numbers doesn't really say much.
You know, your silence is deafening. absolutely deafening. And sidestepping it by saying you're not the CEO is a really Hotsian escape. Is there anything you'd like to add regarding Lewandowski? Not Lewandowski, but his claim that would educate our audience as to what his company's doing?
Well, so I'll say this. When I was CEO, I played a character. I'm not CEO anymore. I don't play that character. This is more like who I am in real life. What I would like to see from anybody, if they want to make any sort of claim, is please ship. It's about what I can buy. It's not about your demo. It's not about what you've managed to get the news to write about you. It's not about what you say about yourself in a Medium post. It's about what you actually release and ship.
That's a fair statement, which I'm sorry, I got to ask you this now. Back in the day, when you there was a famous moment where you were at a conference and said something, and who was it? Was it Rosekind? Somebody took umbrage, this letter got sent to Comma. Who was that? Do you remember who that was? Was it Rosekind?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, so today, Rosekind is at Zooks, and pretty much everybody who's worked at NHTSA back in that era now works for a self-driving company. You know, Nathaniel Buse is at Uber. I mean, everyone's jumped over. Is there any, what's the transparency or intellectual honesty around regulation of this technology from the government side?
I mean, this is the same revolving door with regulators you see in every other industry. I've been outside America for a while. This is a peculiar American thing.
Explain that.
Like, it's a scam. Everyone knows what it is. It's not even like worth talking about. A lot of people have talked about it, but it just shows you like how much respect you should really give to these people.
Should private companies be trying to develop like tests or standards for establishing the safety of their systems rather than waiting for regulators to come up with something?
Well, absolutely. Yeah. If you're a private company working on this, you absolutely should have some good internal metrics about safety.
Since we don't really have like an underwriter's laboratory for safety, and you know, IIHS hasn't really grabbed onto this as aggressively they could have. And do you think there's some possibility of forming a consortium, but a legitimate consortium of self-driving companies to come up with standards before they're incompetently forced on them?
That sounds vaguely like collaboration. I'm not sure how well that works. But I will say this. If Uber had taken an Eon today, which they could have bought for $700, and put it in their car and just turned on the driver monitoring feature, you know, there would have been no Uber crash.
Okay. So you said earlier that driver monitoring is mandatory, I think you said. But it's mandatory for your system, and yet Tesla doesn't have one. Although there is a cabin-facing camera in the Model 3, which appears to be inactive. Do you think that DMS systems, camera-based, should be made mandatory for all cars, with or without L2 or real ADAS?
No.
Why not?
I think that's an extreme position.
Why?
Because what are you going to do with all the cars that are already on the road today? I like the mandatory DMS while the L2 system is engaged because you're giving the people something and you're taking something. It's a fair trade. You can't just take something. There'll be outrage.
And, you know, Euro NCAP has said that DMSs will be mandatory in order to get a 5-star rating in, I think, 2020.
They'll be mandatory, period, in 2023 for L2 systems in Europe.
So do such systems have to have a capacitive touch, or is a torque sensor on the wheel sufficient?
Oh, no, I think you need a camera. I don't think any of those are good.
So camera plus capacitive touch, camera plus torque, or just camera?
I think just camera's okay, particularly if the camera can see the wheel.
The entire, just the top of the wheel?
It'd be nice to see the whole wheel.
Yeah, what about at like nighttime and things like that?
Use infrared. But yeah, no, I don't even think touching the wheel is that important. I think it's much more important that you are alert, whatever that means.
And I guess, let me try to make this my last question, because I can go on with you, George, all day. The DMS systems, there's a few of them out there. They've raised money and they cost money. You are using, you're downloading something, I think you said you got it off GitHub. Like, is there any defensible advantage over, you know, these DMS systems over what you're deploying in your platform?
Well, so it's based off of open source research that we downloaded from GitHub. We did build some software on top of that. All the software we took from GitHub does, it's called PRNet, and it classifies what direction people's faces are looking. That's not enough to say whether they're paying attention or not. So then we wrote software on top of that. No, absolutely not. There's a lot of companies out there that are offering less than comma and trying to charge you for it.
How much better can DMS systems, camera-based systems get in terms of what they can recognize in terms of aware driver awareness?
Imagine you had a person in the passenger seat watching the driver. That's how good they can get.
That's a pretty good answer.
Full-time job.
Ed, you have any more questions for our friend?
How do you know when you're DMS, like how do you test the efficacy of your DMS system? Like it seems like kind of a tricky thing to measure, like how well it's actually working and then how you improve it.
Yeah. So we get all the data back from people who opt in. So about 20% of Comma AI users opt in to have their video, their front-facing camera videos uploaded. It is opt-in. It's not mandatory that you upload that. But from those who do, we improve the system. We have human labelers, which basically watch the video and say whether they're paying attention or not.
Well, this has been a very special episode, a Christmas special, including George Hotz. Thank you so much for coming, George.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we're doing a couple things at CES. So I'm going to be there for TechCrunch. Certainly doing a lot of writing and meeting up with people. And there's some demos that I want to see and some announcements. Some interesting things are going to happen. And Ed and Alex are also going to be there. We're going to have our anti-CES party, which last year was a lot of fun. This year, we've upgraded. And so it won't be, you know, in a 500 square foot hotel room with 200 people. But the other interesting thing is that we're going to be doing a little bit of programming with Avis.
Avis Ventures.
Yeah. Well, actually, Avis Group, but yeah, in connection with Avis Ventures. And it's going to be really interesting. We're going to do a couple of shows in the North Hall. We'll promote that later via Twitter. So keep an eye out for that.
Yeah. And, you know, if you want to meet up with us at CES, you can reach all of us at our first name at atonicast.com. So that's Kirsten at atonicast.com, Alex at atonicast.com, or Ed at atonicast.com. And we will see you here again next time on another episode of the Atonicast.
Next year, actually.
Next year.